Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning host, co-host Daniel Doughty. Did I pronounce that right?
Close. I'll answer to it. Usually we go with Doughty, but it's Doughty. That's Doughty. Way better than I usually hear. You're good.
Oh, okay. now you were on. What was the last time you were on? Was it for Poe, or was it?
Yeah. So I guess this makes me a three time. This is my third time on the show. The last time we did the Edgar Allan Poe, Fall of the House of Usher, and the Mask of the Red Death. And then I also was on early, I guess about a year before that, for Puritans, that lady, Scarlet Letter.
Well, first of all, you get a letter jacket now, just like on Saturday Night Live. And second of all, why don't you remind everyone out there where else they can hear you?
Sure. Well, I have a podcast of my own, which I co-host with bosom chum Claude Myron Guzer. We have a podcast called The Cannonball, canon spelled C-A-N-O-N, wherein the idea is that we're reading our way through Harold Bloom's The Western Canon, big scary air quotes for that. So all those great classics, we're reading through them one by one and just kind of just to show about how we encounter the text and sort of just discussing what it means to be. What does canonicity mean to me? But it's a lot of fun. So if I imagine if you're listening to Sophomore Lit, you're up the bookish bent. So please check out The Cannonball. And that's where you can hear more of me and more of the much more astute and informed Claude talk about the great books of the Western canon.
Well, I imagine you do a lot more Rabelais than I've done on this podcast.
I don't think we haven't gotten to Rabelais yet. I have read Molière, so there's a little feather in my cap. Yeah, I would not have otherwise. But
knowing your background is in history, I pitched this idea to you that this time we're going to do Howard Zinn's 1980, A People's History of the United States. Although I read the most latest edition, which I guess is going to be the last edition, mm-hmm. with the death of Zen. But so this follows us down into the post 9/11 in this edition. Mm-hmm. Is this a book you've read before?
It is, in fact. I guess I could have been typecast for this episode from two angles, because not only do I have a history educational background, but I am also a card-carrying socialist in my wallet as we speak. But I have read the book before. It's been many, many years because, well, I guess I should say, okay, I haven't read the book before, but rather in my AP US history class in high school, my instructor used excerpts from that he got from A People's History of the United States. He liked using the primary source excerpts that Zinn put in the book, and it was odd. There was an odd way for me to be introduced to the book, basically, like because this AP US history teacher. I mean, we've all taken high school history, and it is of course usually a coach who, they rope into blandly going over names and dates, but the AP US history teacher he was actually our head football coach, but he also was actually deeply interested in United States history. It was a game changing class for me because I was always deeply ambivalent toward United States history. I did not really give a rat's butt. Not from any sort of particular ideological standpoint or anything. It's just I was much more interested in ancient Rome and that kind of stuff. But he was such an engaging teacher, and the perspectives just that I had never really considered before and had never been presented before that he drew out of Zinn were really eye-opening. It actually engendered a real interest in United States history for me. And I say it was a bit unusual because, well, yeah, he was a head football coach at a high school in Alabama in the 90s. Like this was not anyone who would fall anywhere on what we would know as a left spectrum. But he appreciated history enough to know that Zinn had done some good work in, I guess, curating a collection of underrepresented primary source voices. And my favorite fact about this particular instructor of mine is that he retired from teaching the year after this APUS history class that meant so much to me to go become the offensive line coordinator for the XFL team, the Birmingham Thunderbolts.
Oh, my God. Yes. XFL.
So I was introduced to Howard Zinn by an XFL coach.
A note to the listeners out there, probably a lot of you are familiar with this book. Others of you may be scratching your head to figure out exactly how this book fits into the mission statement of Sophomore Lit. My first response to that is I kind of torn up the mission statement to Sophomore Lit a long time ago, but I think, actually fit in pretty well. It's a survey book of American history. If you're not familiar with it, the initial version was written in 1980, that takes a highly revisionist approach to an American history survey text. Obviously, revisionist history is nothing new by the time of 1980, but this was a watershed moment to try and put together something resembling a survey class textbook that would take an outsider view of American history. And specifically, the mission statement was to look at the communities of American history, their story from within, as opposed to any kind of official narrative that would be imposed on the actions of history from the top down. Mm-hmm. Today, I don't think it would be seen as a particularly unheard of exercise, but at the time it was electric and it became something of a rallying cry. Now at first it wasn't used much in high schools. It was used in a lot of college classes, but over time it has actually gotten to the point that people's history of the United States did get taught in high school classes. There was, I believe, a version rewritten for use as a high school text.
Yeah, I'm going to mention that there's a I've actually seen it at the library. That's my day job when I'm not podcasting. This is actually a trend in a lot of history texts. Like if you have like blockbuster history books like that, Chasing Lincoln's Killer and stuff like that, there will be a young adult edition created of it. But yeah, there was one for A People's History of the United States. I was a little gobsmacked when I saw it at first, but then it made sense because if it's going to be assigned to like high school students, like, well, something rewritten to be a little less imposing might be called for. Yeah.
Right. Now, that's the other thing about this book. When I suggested this, I was not quite aware of how big a book this is, because I had it in my Kindle edition, which is deceiving. The Kindle edition at the print size that I had it set for was something like 500 pages long or something like that.
Yeah.
But I have it open on my desktop Kindle application, and I can see right now it says location 13,124 out of 14,167. So it's a long book.
it's a beast. Yeah.
And it was a book that I suggested to you, I believe, in early summer or something like that.
I was going to say, yeah. That was, I think if I recall correctly, the original plan was you said like, oh, yeah, sometime like mid July or something. And I was like, oh, yeah, sure. Right on.
And one of the things I have to say, you know, reading this through, while it certainly has an attitude and a point of view, reading it through and trying to keep it all in your head is sort of like reading through any history of the United States that tries to be encyclopedic. This, I think, doesn't try to be encyclopedic in any way. It's not a bit, patchwork, you know, but you're going to, whether or not you can keep names and dates in your head will probably depend upon your familiarity with the material to begin with. But it is a book that gets taught in a lot of college classes still. And there is now a Howard Zinn Foundation, I believe, for teaching this in high school classes. I believe my kid had to read some of this as part of the Facing History in Ourselves mm-hmm. program that they had there, which is another nonprofit lefty commie pinko organization out there trying to warp your kids' brains.
I was going to say, it sounds like they're undermining American values with this stuff, John.
This is a book that really tries to take the point of view of let's look at these watershed moments in American history, at least the moments that typically get pointed to mm-hmm. as formative of the American character, and let's try to find what the story is of the communities who may have lost.
Right. It's interesting that you mentioned like it is expansive and it sort of verges on encyclopedic, but the fact that it really isn't trying to be exhaustive. And I sort of realized when you said that this is a work that is I believe best interpreted if you have already read a survey of the sort of ruling class approved narrative of American greatness. Like it really only even would make sense if you have that the connective tissue of the official story to tie it together.
It jumps back and forth between some highly specific passages in mm-hmm. American history. Early on, they talk about they talk about Bacon's Rebellion, which is a very interesting and lesser taught part of American history, at least in high school survey classes. I remember mm-hmm. vaguely it being mentioned, but it's something that I come across again and again as an interested reader. So I was interested to have a chapter that was more on that kind of like a more exhaustive mm-hmm. look at that, and made me want to go out and find some books on this. But then they have things like chapters on chattel slavery in America, which is such a huge topic, and it's just consigned to yet another chapter in this book, and it goes, you know, from 1480, whatever, when slavery is introduced in...
Right, like the Portuguese, Portuguese first start trading slaves a little before Columbus makes his famous voyage, yeah.
Right, and then it just goes down through... the right. Civil War.
Yeah.
And it kind of expects you to make sense of it as a reader.
Yeah, it's I don't want to use the term perfunctory, but
go ahead. Go ahead and use the term perfunctory.
It does seem a little perfunctory, and I think that might be part of the trap that Zinn sets up for himself in being the contrarian in trying to find other angles in the narratives and whatnot, because of the untoward aspects of God. And I hate using such a euphemistic phrase, but anyway, just bear with me. Of the untoward aspects of American history, the aspects of American history that aren't necessarily the kind that make you want to wave the flag and go rah, rah, rah. The Atlantic slave trade and chattel slavery and racialized caste slavery is the one that gets the most attention. It is really for very good reason, because it is extremely foundational and is extremely it cannot be teased out really from a lot of other things. But I think was part of if I had to give my best faith reading of Zinn sort of relegating it to one chapter, it's that like, well, this is well covered in other places. This doesn't, you know, I'm trying to do something else here, but it's a little, it really does the whole topic a disservice. And I feel like Zinn kind of, there was a really missed opportunity. That's been something over the last 20 years or so that a concerted scholarly investigation of the intersection and the interrelated, and in some cases, absolutely foundational relationship between chattel slavery and the development of what's called the market revolution in American history. That is kind of the burgeoning industrial capitalism. Really, over the last like 20 years or so, that has been a major field of very fascinating original archival research. A lot of very troubling and fascinating perspectives are coming out of that. And I really feel like, if anyone was going to get that kickstarted, it would have been Zinn. He could have really got that going, but you know, who knows why he decided to do what he did.
Listeners out there who are used to this as primarily a literature podcast, mm-hmm. I'm going to attempt to get my sleeves up and talk about history in historiography here. I think Daniel, you're much closer to this discipline than I am. Zinn presents this book as what's called a narrative history, meaning it tries to posit through lines of narrative. Yeah. There's like stories involved. There are characters that are treated in a semi-literary way. I'm not sure that it actually ends up being that much of a narrative history. It's narrative only insofar as each chapter has a plot that he wants to tell,
right,
and he's going to develop that plot, and that plot is usually about how the official history privileges the interests of a specific class, mm-hmm, usually a moneyed class or a class in power, and that there is another story that would go along with that. So from the very beginning, we start with the discovery of the Americas by Christopher Columbus, and we are told it from the standpoint of the inhabitants of Hispaniola, or wherever it was they landed. I can't remember.
I think it was Hispaniola. Well, at least that's the, I think like the first landing was some islet off the coast of Hispaniola, but the at least Zinn's narrative begins with the Arawak people of Hispaniola.
So as you can imagine, this book is not a book you turn to for light chuckles as you finish your work day. This is the kind of book that I think sets out to put splinters under your fingernails, and whether or not it succeeds, has to do with both your politics, but also your, in my case, where this book fell apart was it didn't quite hit the sweet spot between being an exhaustive academically written history, mm-hmm, and a popular work. Zinn does not cite anything, for example, in this book. There's lots of quotes, but none of them are cited in the work.
Which is extremely frustrating because, I think like you mentioned earlier, and I think this is really one of the strong points of the people's history. And I think something that is, at least for me, was the most important thing that I got out of it. It really does make you want to learn a lot more about these things he's talking about. It makes you want to go down the rabbit hole. It makes you want to follow up on it. And the fact that he's not citing things so that you can then go follow up on it and that you have to like do a little more digging yourself. Like, I mean, I don't mind that so much. But you know, also at the same time, like, well, yeah, cause I have, you know, a slight amount of academic training and I'm a professional librarian. Like, I think for anybody else who like, you know, thought like, oh, well, that is interesting, I'd like to know more. And then they're left kind of high and dry. Like, you know, that's extremely frustrating because it really undercuts what I think is one of the stronger aspects of the work.
When he quotes primary sources, quite frequently he's quoting letters or journals or the sort of narrative histories that were written in the time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's difficult to tease out why he's focusing on one person or another. We don't really have any sense of with what authority each of these people is speaking. Now that, mm-hmm, that's part of Zinn's project, is he's trying to recover voices that are not the official voices, but it's difficult when you are trying to tease out exactly what point of view these people are coming from as well, and how much credibility we give to their observations. Mm-hmm.
It would have done for Zinn to explain why he feels like this or that excerpt is representative of something, like why he feels like this, you know, because if you're going to, you know, in a way, of course, the historian's curse is, of course, we cannot have a direct brain plug link into the minds and experiences of everyone that is encountering these particular events and people and whatnot. I mean, you know, Lord above, I hope that is the case someday. But, you know, you're going to necessarily have to pick and choose what text you present in order to make your particular argument or explain any particular circumstance. And if you aren't, it's just kind of a basic, you know, we're talking historiography, for folks out there, this is a $10 word for what history of history, basically. It's meta history. Like the method and the and the change over time of how history is researched and presented. But like, if you can't explain why you find this or that person representative of this or that group, the social group, then it's kind of a critical piece that's missing. Yeah. And you just sort of left it to take, you know, to trust Zinn's judgment on it. And, you know, I mean, I would rather not. Yeah, right. I would like to have at least a little more explanation of why he decided this, you know.
Now, I didn't read this book until I read it now for the podcast, but I was very aware of this book. It was. I went to college at Earlham College, which is a liberal arts Quaker school, and fairly left wing, fairly radicalized student base. Mm-hmm. And so this was a popular text around the time that I was in college, which was between 86 and 90. And it reading this through gave me all kinds of weird flashbacks, because there's a point late in the book, in the excerpts, in the afterword, where Zinn talks about how he did this. And he says, there is no such thing as pure fact, innocent of interpretation. Behind every fact presented to the world by a teacher, writer, anyone, is a judgment. The judgment that has been made is that this fact is important and that other facts omitted are not important. Now, this attitude towards of skepticism towards the historical project's objectivity, mm-hmm. I was intimately familiar with. This permeated all of my classes at Earlham, and this was kind of the way in which in the 70s and 80s academics were taught to have this great distrust for the idea of objective fact. And it was something that the left was excoriated for at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
On the right, people were just like, everything's relative. This is the terrible thing that universities have done. And we're just bringing up a whole class of people now who don't believe in anything.
But what it's like, it would be impossible to tell right from wrong if you have just some basic epistemological modesty.
Right. But what gave me chills as I was reading this is it's sort of like the world has turned upside down in the years since then. I think mm-hmm. that in our public discourse these days, there is no one more relativistic than pundits arguing cases on the right.
Oh,
the whole
the whole
idea of Fox News right now is everything is biased. There's no truth. So get your news from the people who share your bias.
Right, right. I think one of the finest expressions of that I've ever seen in my life was and this is a rhetorical strategy that I see again and again. For a while, I've kind of fallen off of it a bit, just because, like, once you see it once, you've seen it, you know, a thousand times. But I used to kind of keep tabs on the creationist scene, kind of what, you know, just out of sheer, just, I don't know, the imp of the perverse rides my curiosity from time to time. But, you know, also it's, you know, I actually went to a high school where there was a warning sticker on the front cover of my biology textbook explaining to me that evolution was just one theory of human origins. And but that attitude is really pervasive in sort of this creationist literature. And I remember there was I don't remember the particular outlet, but I've seen it a few times where the idea is that it's explaining interpretations. You have a fossil in the ground, and it shows the scientist interprets this as evidence that God had nothing to do with anything and that it's X number of millions of years old, etc. But if you look at it from a Christian perspective, it shows this. And the thing is, like, that's the most postmodernist way to go about things I can imagine. Like, you're literally just saying, like, look, you have to choose a lens to view this through. You cannot actually access what's really going on. You're just going to have to choose a worldview. So, you know, there you go. And which is, yeah, you're right. Like, that was supposed to be the great death of civilization. It was just gobsmacking. I that's really stayed with me, like, you know, 10 years after I saw it.
Zinn definitely wears his politics on his sleeve, and he's particularly interested. He talks early on about how he's writing this book as an antidote to the official narrative. What he perceives as happening is that the power interests in a society always from the top down, are interested in creating a narrative of unity. This is the story of America, and it's a story that you can trace through that will be the same for all of us, that we all participate in, and that it's all leading towards this perfect modern moment. He talks early on about the histories of communities and says that the important thing to remember is that communities' interests and the governmental interests or the elite interests are almost never in concert. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I feel on the one hand like I'm enough of a leftist to want to, you know, fist bump and say right on to all this stuff. But but I found myself in the weird situation of being an apologist throughout this book of like saying, well, you know, there were people, you know, working in good faith to try and do certain things, you know, and I felt myself having this kind of creeping existential dread as I was reading this, because we were reading this right in the midst of this last election.
Yeah, just all through the midterm. Yeah, that's right. God, I didn't even think about that.
and I don't know if our listenership was aware of this, but it's been a kind of intense time in this country around the discourse of government, and I find myself a little exhausted right now. I feel radicalized as to the current moment, but I feel less radicalized when it comes to history, because I feel like all I can see as I look through through this stretch of history is a lot of people are really trying to do what they think is right. Yeah. Bless their hearts.
Right,
you know,
right.
And they didn't get it right, but I don't necessarily want to ascribe bad intention to the people who did bad things.
Yeah. Well, I think you hit upon something that is important. And you're right that is a kind of there's a tendency in the people's history of basically like Zen is like, you know, here are these awful malefactors, and here are the evil they are wreaking upon these innocent people. And it's reductive in a very seductive way. And I'll explain what I mean here. Because as you mentioned, there were a lot of people who had the best of intentions and were going about things in a very well-intended way, who nevertheless contributed to some horribly destructive processes and events that were, you know, inflicted on other people. And in a way, I think that's I think it's important to get one's head around the fact that when you're dealing with dynamics around powerful classes and disempowered classes, personal intentions kind of fall by the wayside, because you're dealing with structures and systems that are doing kind of the heavy lifting of the exploitation and the destruction. It's less a matter of, and in a way, I think that's more serious to confront as a human being, as someone who thinks about human beings living together, that, you know, it's not just a story of, you know, the evil Snidely Whiplash sitting in the White House doing evil things for the sake of being evil. It's evil things are happening while people think they're doing their best. And it's, I don't know, maybe it's a distinction without a difference. I mean, I don't know, but I think definitely when it comes to trying to come to grips with the history of one's own society, I think that's an extremely important thing to keep in mind. And the thing is, I think there are some genuine villains in United States history. Andrew Jackson was one of them. I am absolutely, and Zinn spends a lot of time on Jackson, and I think that's very, very important. And it's very important from my own kind of personal history pedagogy, because I live in the part of the continent which was ethnically cleansed by Andrew Jackson. In Alabama, this was the site of what is called the Creek War, or sometimes the Red Stick War, which has gone into in sort of a little bit of depth by Zinn in his chapter on the Indian removals and the Indian removal process. And we were taught the Red Stick War. I actually remembered these terms because in fourth grade, when you are 9 years old in Alabama, you have an Alabama history unit that your class goes through, and they do it again in ninth grade. And we actually use the same textbook for both. I remember that now, for 9-year-olds and 14-year-olds. But the way that the war is sort of framed, at no point did it even really feel like we were talking about anything that had a moral dimension to it. Like, you know, it just is just sort of this recitation of like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And one thing that I really appreciated about Zen and the way he talks about this particular event is because, like, not only is like, okay, this is stuff that happened where I live here now because of these things that happened. I was taught about these things in a way that minimized them. And, you know, and the way Zen puts it with, you know, with actual, you know, direct quotes from people like Jackson, this was ethnic cleansing. This was going in with guns and bayonets and forcing people to vacate land so that other people could come in with enslaved people of African descent to make money growing cotton. That's why they did it. And it's like, and at the same time, like a lot of the, you know, I guess to get back to the kind of like villain, you know, just how villainous were these people? Like a critical mass of them were actually villainous, but a lot of other people just kind of went along with it because like, hey, you know, the glorious Andrew Jackson got rid of that horrible problem out there, you know, and I'm just trying to get by, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But that was something that really stuck with me. And after reading that portion, I was taking a walk around the, my workplace, which is a public library in one of the richer suburbs of the Birmingham metro area. And it had a little historical marker and it about like, you know, when, you know, this town was settled. And it said, you know, settlers first arrived in 1821 and whatever. And I immediately thought to myself, oh crap. Yeah. That's like 2 years after the Red Stick War. There's a reason why it is then that settlers arrived in this place where I'm walking. And that I found myself really appreciating Zen's project in that moment, because it brought a lot home in a very sort of personal way. I don't know.
My favorite chapters were chapters like that. The chapters that dealt with a very specific passage in American history rather mm-hmm. than like a large theme. There was the one that we talked about, the one that was on the theme of slavery in the U.S. There was also one mm-hmm. on the place of women, which
yeah,
I thought
that was another one
broad and it didn't seem particularly incisive. I think that the history of women's oppression in the United States is richly complicated by the fact that women, more than any other oppressed group, have a buy-in to the culture. You know, men and women are married together. They share families. They share property.
Yeah.
They share history in a way that, unfortunately, other oppressed classes are often cut off. So
yeah,
there's this weird way in which women throughout American history, while they've been oppressed, also see their interests as you know, coalescing with those of the men in their lives because
yeah.
they're family. They have an emotional connection. Now in an era when we're much more attuned to intersectionality, it's a situation that overlaps with a lot of other messy divisions in American history. And mm-hmm. I thought that this chapter was just broad and uninteresting. And it kind of like ticked off little notes here, like, okay, we're going to talk about, you know, these suffragettes here. We're going to talk about I liked the passages that were much more about a specific moment in American history. I think that those are the passages that are better served by a narrative approach.
Yeah. 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 I think you're right. It's the, that was also the chapter I felt was the clunkiest, like even more so than the, you know, it was perfunctory, like about you know, about chattel slavery, and for all those reasons that you laid out. Yeah. And it's like, it does make a very, it makes for strange bedfellows, because you have a chapter which is about kind of like, you know, suffragette struggles and whatnot. And it has like figures like, say, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who, I mean, if I'm recalling correctly, was also pretty down on enfranchisement of people of color. Like, she was, you know, she was an activist for, you know, women's enfranchisement, but also is on record as, you know, as being against the enfranchisement of Black people. And that, and she's sharing a chapter with Sojourner Truth. And it's a bit, yeah, it's a bit like there's a lot more going on than the kind of the way it's laid out allows for. And again, let's, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that I wanted to read a 1500 page People's History of the United States for it to get it right, but I think it may have been a moment for Zinda maybe sort of come out of the gate with a little humility and explain that, like, look, I'm not going to be able to do this justice. And I feel like he maybe does that a little bit in the, at least the introduction to the edition I had. I feel like there is that kind of, like, there's no way any one work can encompass everything. But I feel like maybe he should have taken a few moments to explain that, you know, and other critical points in the text.
This book makes a lot more sense in 1980 than it does today. It's written in that great history of alternative reference works. You know, if you think back to the 1960s and 70s, you had books like Our Bodies, Ourselves that came out at that time, which were trying to counteract the lack of good information for women on health. And there was things like the Whole Earth Catalog and these sorts of things, all these big telephone books that were trying to be references that when you felt like you couldn't really trust the official references out there. Now, what's interesting about this is coming on at the very end of that. And it's trying in its way to be a little bit more scholarly, but it doesn't want to have all the scholarly apparatus of footnotes and citations. It also probably could have used, I think, an editorial hand, you know, like sending it around to a few more people. This is the funny thing about the humanities, you know, is that the sciences, you send things around and they're mercilessly peer-reviewed. The humanities are also peer-reviewed, but I don't get the feeling this book was really peer-reviewed.
Yeah, like it's, and I guess I don't know enough, I don't know enough about Zinn's own academic career to know, like, I don't know, maybe a listener can let us know, or if you don't, John, but like, was he fairly well established in 1980? Was he like a kind of like, was he a fairly well-known academic? And so he kind of like, well, he's the big dog. He can just do what he wants. Or, I mean, I guess it does seem odd that there's not, like a sterner editorial hand would have served him very well. But,
I mean, he was, and this is all here from Wikipedia, so don't, I don't know any, I can't.
Yeah, we'll have to consult the People's Wikipedia after this.
Oh, wow. He worked at Boston University. I got my two masters from Boston University.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, he was a professor of political science.
Okay.
And according to this highly abridged and who knows who wrote it thing in Wikipedia, his point of view was that he identified himself as a Marxist. So it makes sense. I mean, but the thing, it's certainly a passionate book, and I think you could pick up and read any one chapter in this book and be really engrossed. Whether or not you would want to read the whole thing through at once, or whether or not it would serve as an alternative textbook, which I think is sort of the way it's presented, whether or not it actually ever could reasonably be used as an alternative.
Yeah, that seems like a grievous misuse of the text, honestly. but yeah, you're right. It kind of like, I guess I could say like, it would make a really great kind of bathroom book for when you feel like getting really mad, you know, on the toilets. And sometimes
that
you do,
must
man.
Be something like that. Yeah. What was that uncle, what's his name?
The Uncle John's bathroom readers. Yeah.
Right. They could have the Uncle Carl's bathroom readers.
Oh man. See, this is all right. Now, TM. All right. Trademark. We're going into business with this, John.
I'm sure that Carl would be glad to hear that we had a plan to make $1 million off of him.
Exactly. Hey, you know, he was nothing if not an appreciator of ironies. I guess we're speaking to like the, kind of the episodic sort of nature of it. I guess I wanted to ask you, John, I was really curious to know, like, what chapters really jumped out to you, or which ones introduced you to topics that you were just completely out to lunch on, like the most, and made you the most curious about. And if you like, I can go first to sort of give you an idea of what I'm asking. Or okay, because I really, really loved the there was a chapter. It was called The Other Civil War, But this was basically a kind of an overview of class struggles, like class-based conflicts in the United States, sort of around the just throughout the whole 19th century, basically from before the Civil War and on into the Reconstruction era. And buddy, I learned about so many things that I had no idea about. And it was really, really eye-opening, especially there was the sort of the anti-rent movement, that like revolt of tenants in the Hudson Valley, upstate New York, which was basically there was like this holdover, like aristocratic Dutch, like literally speaking Dutch, like aristocratic landowning class that had serfs essentially in this Hudson Valley agricultural system. So you had like almost like basically just non-free tenant farmers rose up in revolt against this sort of pseudo aristocratic pseudo feudal arrangement in the I think that was in the 1830s. And I had never heard of that in my entire, and I'm a giant dork, and I am a I'm fascinated with like leftist history and everything. I'd never come across that before in my time, and I just absolutely loved learning some more about that.
I like that chapter. I like the chapter that came right after that on robber barons and rebels. My own interest in American literature and in American visual arts. I work in a museum in my real job, and I'm fascinated with the Gilded Age. Mm-hmm. It touched on so many aspects of oppositional movements towards the growing robber barons, which I wasn't really aware was a thing. I mean, I my understanding of the American labor movement is actually mostly around the growth of unions in the like 1910s and 1920s in response to things like the Triangle Shirt Factory stuff and that. And I wasn't aware that there were organized resistance during the Gilded Age. I mean, it makes sense. And, you know, so much of the literature of the time, you know, the Edith Wharton, the Mark Twain and stuff was about sort of the excesses of the era and how everything was going to come crashing down, which it did. But again, it's a little survey-ish. It's sort of like I want to like find out more. I want to go back and read up on all these people. They had the section on the Haymarket Martyrs and the Homestead Strikers. I'd like to know more about this stuff. And I guess I just hadn't ever been exposed to that. Mm-hmm. You know, it reminds me, I've told the story before. The high school I went to didn't have like history classes. It had sort of broadly stated cultural studies classes.
And sure, sure.
There's an advantage to that and a disadvantage to that. The advantage to that is you get to mix up your art with your history and all the stuff, and it's kind of nice. But then everything is very patchwork, and it's very much what the teacher decides is important. By the time I got to college, I was taking classes in history, but they were very specific classes in history. They were like,
college history is, it drills down.
Right. And it wasn't until after I was out of college and I was getting ready for my graduate studies. I was like, I need to fill in some gaps in my American history. And I got, it's called America. It's a textbook that is just starts at the 16th century and goes down to whatever the current edition's date was.
Yeah, runs around the Korean War, every textbook.
Right, right, right. And I was enjoying it. I was reading it, and suddenly I got to the part after World War I, and they talked about the Spanish flu, and I had never heard of the Spanish flu up to that point.
Wow.
And I was a college educated kid who had gone through public high school, through a good college course. I was like 23 or something like that. And I read this discussion that more people died in the Spanish flu than in World War One. I think even more than like in World War Two. It was like, and people were treating it at the time like it was the end of the world. And I'm like, why didn't anyone ever tell me this was a thing?
This seems really important.
It seems like it really, but then I realized that part of the problem with it is it's as a historical fact, doesn't necessarily fit into any kind of a clear narrative about who the America is or the world is or where modernism was heading. It was sort of like, okay, we just made it out of World War One, and suddenly we're struck by this pandemic like the world has never known.
Yeah.
You would think that with the AIDS crisis, there would be an interest in bringing up previous pandemics to see how people dealt with them. But for some reason, I never got that. And this is the thing I always feel about history. I guess history is a kind of a bottomless pit in a way. You know, there always will be something you'll come across that you'll say, like, why didn't I know about this before?
Yeah.
So this book, you know, has a bit of that, but it gives the veneer of being encyclopedic. But I think you kind of quickly realize that it's going to be Zinn picking up like this personal account that he wants to stick in because it makes a good pull quote, you know, at this rather than.
I mean, it's clear that that's what's happening from the very start, because you have, you know, chapter one, you know, it just jumps right in with, you know, the story of the encounter between the Spanish and other colonizers and the indigenous people of the Americas. And it takes it up to some of the sort of colonial wars between the indigenous peoples of New England and the English colonies up there. And it kind of like it. I don't know. And then it jumps right into that that chapter that we talked about the just takes on the entirety of slavery in one go. And it's very clearly it's like, well, OK, like a lot of stuff, other stuff happened in between and like sort of off stage from all this, which is kind of what I meant earlier when I said, like, if you don't have the, you know, the sort of the strung together master narrative, like you're going to be out to lunch on a lot of this stuff if you don't have that connective tissue to put it together. So I think any pretensions toward it being a kind of a, it's not a counter history in the sense that you can read it and have the same broad understanding of the, what, you know, political and economic and social development of people on the American continent for the last couple hundred years. It's not going to give you that.
And the other thing that, as you mentioned that occurs to me, this book, while it tries to act as an antidote to traditional American histories, it suffers from some of the same myopia that traditional American history does. I was thinking just now as you were talking about Columbus's the chapter on Columbus, in American history texts, we always have this, here comes Columbus in 1492. He finds these people and then jump ahead to Jamestown.
Right. Yeah. And there's like 100 years between those two things.
And what happens is like, what happened to all the Spanish settlers? What were they up to? What were they doing? You know, later we get to the Mexican-American War, and we do see this sort of for the interests of the Mexicans versus the Americans. But one of the things that Americans are terribly underserved by the public school history is the history of not just Native American peoples in the United States, which we should know more about, but the histories of other European peoples other than the English. You know, we have this narrative that begins with Jamestown 1605 and Plymouth Plantation 1620. That's like, and everything before that is not history, you know. And obviously the colonization had been going on for like 150 years before that.
Yeah. And in such a, like, you know, and that the English effort was in response to these other European powers doing this. Yeah. There's, it touches on a little bit because the, that first chapter about, you know, Columbus does, it does bring up Bartolomé de las Casas, who is a fascinating figure, and I would urge everyone to look into this guy. He was a Spanish priest, who upon seeing what the Spanish regime was doing to the indigenous peoples of Central and South America, became a vociferous advocate against the colonial project and in favor of indigenous people. But you're right that there's this massive disservice done by the what we might call the Anglocentric, view of what happened in North America, because, you do miss this kind of, and I think it's very illustrative to think about, because even think about the experience of indigenous peoples, as they encountered these various, European states and their sort of semi-state adventurer actors, like the conquistadors, I think it's illustrative of the different approaches that they took to exploiting this new continent, because what do you have in South America? Like, even to this day in, say, Mexico, there's a very large indigenous population there, and they would have encountered the same pandemics that the same sort of biological crises that led to depopulation in the United States. But it just, I think that highlights that as far as the English colonies were concerned and their successor state, the United States of America, that the way to adequately exploit this continent was to clear people off of it and take that over. Whereas the Spanish approach was more like, oh, well, here is yet another resource that this continent offers, are these people sure. that we can dominate.
And there was the French approach that was right. very much one of coexistence. I mean, not that there was that much better, but it was right, but at least they, yeah, they let there was people
more,
live.
Yeah, and there was more collaboration. It was more like sending small bands of traders out into the, into Indian country and all that. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, this is all, Zen, man, this is all right here before you. You could have done this, but yeah.
Now, we should probably... it occurs to me as we've been talking about this that we've been talking in a lot of generalities. again, this is a book that's difficult to talk about that way. You could argue with individual facts, I guess, in the book if you wanted to. This is not a book like most books on this podcast where we can talk about characters, but we can talk also about themes. Mm-hmm. And early on, when in the chapter. A kind of revolution. Zinn gives this sort of baby's first Marxist critique.
Right.
He has this thing where he says, when economic interest is seen behind the political causes of the Constitution, then the document becomes not simply the work of wise men trying to establish a decent and orderly society, but the work of certain groups trying to maintain their privileges while giving just enough rights and liberties to enough of the people to ensure popular support. And it's not groundbreaking here,
right?
But
right.
It's a good sort of jumping off point for a young reader, I suppose. But while I agree with him about the importance of viewing the formation of the United States under the constitutional era, mm-hmm. you really do have to look at it through the lens of economic interests, mm-hmm. and particularly the interests of slaveholding versus non-slaveholding states, you do it a disservice to reduce it entirely to that.
Yeah.
It's always been this weird, bastardized set of compromises and weird dealings between different interests. And that's one of the things about the U.S. that I kind of wish Zinn would be a little more even-handed with mm-hmm. Is the fact that there are people who had extremely high ideals, and they also had very bad ideas, and right. quite frequently they were the same people.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's the kind of thing where the way I think of it all the time is when you think of the Constitution, you have to remember it is a framework, it is a document, a blueprint for a state, a political state, that was constructed by people who claim to own other human beings in order to make themselves richer, and other people who were willing to work with those people. But you're right that, that doesn't preclude that anyone actually did think that, well, this is a new, you know, a new dawn in sort of human understandings of one another and what a polity can be. Like, it's, you know, there's a reason why the American Revolution and the Constitution were such watershed events globally. I mean, because it was very explicitly, like, say, the French Revolution, which of course had tremendous consequences for the continent of Europe and you know, because of colonialism and imperialism, the entire world was very much inspired by a lot of these ideas and events. And it's kind of like, you know, a lot of left wing people hold the French Revolution holds a very special place in their hearts, while they kind of turn their nose up at the American Revolution. But the people at the time certainly didn't think that way. You know, there's an interconnection between, and I guess to put it in more of a nutshell, and I blather on a bit, but there's, I think we underestimate the capacity and the tendency for people to understand their high ideals and their material interests as being in concert. And that it's not necessarily, you know, yeah, I guess to kind of go back to what we were talking about earlier with kind of villainy versus structure or whatever, like it's a reductive and I think at the end of the day, counterproductive way of thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, we should probably wrap up this particular podcast. I just want to note that we did read, or at least I read, I assume you read too, the last edition of this book, which it follows us all the way up to 2001. Mm-hmm. And for my mind, the most fascinating chapter, although also the most frustrating one for me, was the one on the Clinton years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it takes a very jaundiced and critical look towards neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. I get it. I understand why people are very frustrated with that, and particularly with Clinton's weird capitulation to business interests.
Right.
But it is a strange chapter in that I feel like there's a lot of theoretical apparatus that is introduced in that chapter that I was familiar with, you know, mm-hmm. because I'm a pinko commie academic who reads these sorts of things that I don't know that the general readership would get, you know, this whole issue of neoliberalism, I think as a concept is a kind of a more rarefied one. As frustrated and irritated as I am with the Clintons and as full of criticism of them as I am, mm-hmm. As anyone else is, you know, I also know what we were coming out of the Reagan Bush era, and it was, you know, it was a different time, and it was, and I feel like there were good intentions as well as bad intentions in the Clinton administration.
I think it's an interesting chapter because it has that kind of there's not the distance of actual history, right? Like it's so there's not the ability to look back and see what ends up being like, oh, this ends up being important later. This ends up being the germ of something else later. So it ends up being kind of a laundry list of all the crappy stuff that happened, and, which is not unuseful. I mean, I think that's important to like, you know, like I'm a firm believer that you should never have a hero politician. Never believe in any politician at all. Like I am a firm believer in that. And I, you know, that's why when anyone would call me a Bernie bro, I would really prickle up at that. Cause like, oh no, this guy's a jackass just like the rest of them. But yeah, there's still this kind of like, there's this kind of a raw, it's like getting the raw Zen feed instead of something that has at least had like a little time to marinate. And it ends up being a very strange beast. Yeah.
Now I'm really going to date myself to our younger audience here and bear with me a little bit as Uncle John tells you about how things were back in the day, back in the days when people actually had bound encyclopedias.
Yes.
That you had to buy like an edition. You would buy the 1972 edition of the World Book or whatever. it was way too expensive to buy a new edition of the encyclopedia every year.
Oh, yeah.
So they would come out with what they would call a yearbook that would tack on to the end of your encyclopedias. There would be this like yearbook 1973, yearbook 1974. And it would just be like a whole bunch of, oh, here's what happened. And add this to the article.
Catch up. Yeah.
Right. And this really felt like that to me. This felt like, absolutely. Oh, this is a bunch of stuff that happened. Right.
Yeah. Here's a bunch of stuff that happened since I read this. That's exactly it, man. You exactly hit on it. Oh God. Yeah. That explains it all. But yeah, but I guess to kind of, I guess since we're wrapping up, to sort of give my, to put a bow on my feelings about Zinn in this book, I think it's an extremely valuable book, but it is also very prone to misuse. And I think the best thing about it is that if you pick up this book and you open up any chapter, you will be introduced to things you had never heard of and aspects of American history that you'd never thought about, but that really do impact you directly in your life today, that help explain how we got here and how you got to where you are, if you're an American person. And honestly, like, well, given the fact that we have a globe spanning empire, no matter where you are in the world, you know, that has some bearing on what's happening to you. But, so that I think is extremely valuable. Like, no matter what, you'll find something. And if you're anything like me and you want to go down every rabbit hole you find, like, buddy, you know, you're set for life. That being said, it's structurally an absolute mess and should not at all be considered authoritative in any sense or exhaustive. So I guess handle with care, but I trust you, dear listener. I trust you to use it in a way that is responsible and enriching.
Thanks to co-host Daniel Dottie. His podcast is The Cannonball. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write to the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Join us on Facebook or hit us up on the membership Slack. Whatever you do, keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.